Wish you knew more about the medical device industry and how you can do your job more effectively and put your career on the fast track? Then stay tuned while industry veteran Pat Cothey shares strategies and tips from customers and company insiders who help drive the industry. Now let's join Pat as he explores how you can master medical device.
Welcome. Serial entrepreneurs are a rare breed. What drives someone to chase after a dream when the numbers show there are many more failures than there are wins? Stepping out on a ledge with no net below is not for everyone. And for those of us that have done it, you better learn fast. Our guest today is Scott Wolf, founder and chief medical officer of Aaron Medical, where they're providing products to bring relief from nasal airway obstruction and chronic rhinitis. Scott is an MD and is also a prolific medical device entrepreneur across a broad range of therapeutic areas. Prior to founding Aaron Medical, Scott founded Zeltique Aesthetics, the maker of Cool Sculpting, the leading non-invasive method of fat reduction for body sculpting. Scott's other startups include Endogastric Solutions and Cardiac Dimensions. Scott was previously a partner at Prospect Venture Partners and a vice president at Fraser Healthcare Ventures, both leading life science venture capital firms. In this episode, we discuss how he identifies ideas, what criteria he uses to select ideas to work on, how VCs evaluate opportunities, what entrepreneurs should know before they meet with investors, the problems Aaron is addressing, and how they're serving the ENT community. Here's our conversation. Scott, you've had an interesting career journey. You're a physician, an entrepreneur, and you've also been a venture capitalist. So after starting your career, you quickly pivoted to startup world. Can you tell us a little bit about that transition and moving from practicing medicine into this unique space that we're in?
Sure. Yeah, there's a handful of people out there like me, you know, doctors who've gotten into either the investment world in medical devices or the startup world of medical devices. But when I was in medical school, I started to think, you know, to practice medicine effectively, you really can't use your imagination. You can't innovate as you're going along. There's a way to treat diseases that's accepted. And that, it didn't really fit my personality. I like to think of new ideas and was always interested in science and science fiction. So I started to look around, you know, and see maybe if there were other people like me who had this thought. And there was actually a doctor in New York who was forming biotech companies. And so I reached out to him, and after my internship, he gave me a job. So that was my start. This was before the internet. So he gave me a phone book and a desk and told me to find some cool technologies that we could start companies on. So I was there for a couple of years, got to see what that world was like, and then heard about some folks who were, it was a venture firm at the time called Vanguard Venture Partners, who were creating a medical device incubator with Medtronic. And so I begged them to let me run it, and they did. So I moved out to Minneapolis for a few years and did that with Medtronic and got to see the home base of medical devices and how big companies did things, and got my first taste of the startup world, and really just kept going from there. And I really enjoyed the startup process and the thinking about new ideas and thinking about unmet needs in medicine. So really, it really put a lot of my interests together. And along the way, I had the idea I wanted to be a venture capitalist because that is quite a glamorous job. So after forming some more companies, I hooked up with a venture capital firm in Seattle. I actually approached them about a startup. I had the idea that you could non-invasively reduce fat in the body, right? And if you could do that, that would be a great thing, that you don't have to do a lot of market research to know that people want to have fat removed from their bodies. And the bar is a pretty low-hanging bar in terms of getting, if you could do even a little bit, it would be a very successful product. And they said, okay, come on board and we'll fund you to build that company. And that's what I did. That's where I found some inventors at Mass General, really smart guys who had invented CoolSculpting. And so I licensed CoolSculpting and then formed Zeltiq with this venture capital firm, Fraser Healthcare Ventures. And they were very supportive of that company. And then moved on to another venture capital firm, but really realized that I didn't really want to invest in other people's companies. I liked the actual process of creating something from nothing, building something from an idea on paper to a product. This act of creation was meaningful to me. So that's when I went back and formed Aaron Medical.
Many of us learn and pivot based on new things that happen to us. Looking back on your transition, you go into medical school, you spend all that time, you prepare for it, you get in, and then you say, Jesus, this is not for me. Was your personality always like it is today? Or was there something that happened in medical school that says, I need to move out of what I'm doing? I mean, did you fool yourself into saying medicine was going to be good for me? Were you always an entrepreneur, or did something change?
I was always an entrepreneur, but this was a cultural thing. My father didn't go to college. Neither parent went to college, and they said their kids were going to get educated and become professionals. And so I was tapped. My older brother was supposed to be the doctor, but he hated the sight of blood. He would faint at blood. And so then they said, okay, well, Scott will be the doctor. So I was tapped as a kid that I would go to medical school. And in certain cultures, you don't really, I'm sure this resonates with a lot of people who are hearing this, because I didn't question it. I just said, oh, yeah, I'm going to medical school. That was it. I can do it. It'll provide me the kind of life that my parents weren't able to have. So it seemed a great thing to do. It was an honor to get into medical school and be the first one to do it. But yeah, then I got there and it didn't fit my personality. It was eye-opening, though, when I had this realization, oh, wow, I actually don't have to practice medicine. I can use this medical degree. I felt like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. It worked out for the best. But yeah, it took a lot of realization.
Yeah, we have to make our own paths. My older brother, my parents had dubbed him. He was going to be the priest. That never happened.
Right.
They wanted me to go to the Air Force Academy, and I did a little bit of applying there, and then finally said, you know what, that doesn't fit my personality. So we made those decisions a little bit earlier. But as you said, I mean, sometimes you've got a great opportunity ahead of you, and at some point in time, you figure out this isn't for me.
Yeah.
But obviously, entrepreneurship and building things is what turns you on.
Yeah. It's what, I'm one of those people who want to be, think I'm doing something meaningful and important. And if I can feel that, I can really give my all to it. And that's how I feel when I'm building a medical device company, creating a new treatment for people who are suffering from a disease condition. Yeah, I find it to be quite fulfilling in a lot of ways and fun to boot. It's really fun, I think, when something that you conceive of, it comes to fruition and that you've able to really help people through that. It's a fun feeling. I think of artists who create works of art and musicians who, just this act of creation to me is really something that drives me.
So speaking of creation, you've created or founded a few different startups. How many startups is it now?
I have been either founder or co-founder of six. And so, and some have been, I've had the full range of medical device experiences in founding companies. So some have not worked for various reasons, either funding, we couldn't get funding. One failed in late clinical trials, which is just a really tough lesson to learn. You don't want that to happen. You want to wring out all the risk as early as possible. Wring out risk. What's going to work if you can get to that point? And then companies like I'm at now, Aaron Medical, which, you know, is we have two FDA approved products on the market and everything is doing very well. We're growing fast. So it's, you know, so there's, I've seen the full gamut, the, you know, pain of things not working out and the fun of having them.
For those that say they've never failed in a startup, it's really a question, or the comment is yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you will. Yeah. You will for a variety of reasons. I've had it happen. It's, as you said, it is not fun. It is pain associated with it. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, six startups that you've founded. I want to talk about finding ideas and how you find ideas, where ideas come from. Because I'm sure you founded six companies, but there's a lot more than six ideas that you've run down. So what are you looking for when you are looking for ideas? How do you find them?
So it's a big question. My main guiding principle is the idea has to be worth the effort. At the end of the day, this has to be a big idea. This has to be something that can change the way medicine is practiced, that can make things easier and more effective for the patient. And it has to be something in a very large market, because the effort and money required to bring something from an idea to fruition in medical devices is measured in hundreds of millions of dollars. This is a very expensive thing to do, and it's very difficult to raise money along the way. So it has to be an idea that at the end of the day can generate hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for a company. So that's, unfortunately, my number one rule. The other.
Let's pause there for a second, because that is definitely an opinion that's out there, that, you know, pick a huge unmet need to go after, because it does take, but medicine is also, and devices are also incrementally improved. So if you don't incrementally improve on those devices, there's missed opportunity as well. How do you balance that between looking at opportunities that are incremental and large markets versus that huge opportunity?
I think it's the role of the large company and the established companies to incrementally improve things. And it's just, there's not, you know, again, you can have devices in large markets, let's say AFib, for instance. That's an incredibly large market with unending need. And so if you have a device that is incrementally better and have patent protection for it and you know, have a path to market, that is something that could probably support a startup company. But for most startup companies, there's so many things, so many check boxes that you have to have patent protection, right? So an incremental improvement is less likely to have a good patent portfolio. And if you don't have a good patent portfolio, you're not going to be able to get the financing. The general rule, I think, still stands that it doesn't have to be alone in its field of attacking this very large market, but it has to be a new idea.
So a couple of things here. One is, you know, obviously nothing happens without money. There's a couple different sources, main sources of money in our space. One's angel money, one's VC money. And sometimes this incremental stuff can be done with angel money and not VC money. And VC money may have different criteria of investing than angel money does. So I think that may be kind of one of those other things. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, when you say big market, large opportunity, what's big for you? Is it 100 million, 500 million, a billion, 5 billion? What's a big market?
I think 500 million on up, and the ability to generate, to have your product generate over $100 million in revenue every year, and is kind of that's how I would define it. If you have ideas that are going to generate less revenue, let's say one day, that doesn't mean you can't start a company on it, or that can't be developed. it's just different from what I do, because I really only know one way of doing things, you know. So I go the road of trying to find one of these very large markets, getting angel financing. The angel financing then will lead in later rounds after you've run out some risk to venture capital financing. And so that's how you continue to keep funding these companies.
So your first screening criteria is market opportunity. What other things are you looking to evaluate, whether it's worth your time to devote to it?
So that there is a path to FDA approval that's reasonable. I think the FDA does a good job of protecting us from dangerous medicines, medical devices. But as medical device developers, we have to have a path through that. So if the FDA is going to require 1,000-patient clinical trial, that's usually not workable for a startup company. So you look at FDA path, you look at path to reimbursement. Getting reimbursement is just the fact that we need in medical devices. We need CPT codes for physicians to get paid for what they do. So we need either the best is having an existing code, and next is the ability to get a good new code.
As you're going through your criteria then, on the FDA side, are PMA devices in or out for you? And is our new reimbursement codes, does that mean it's acceptance or non-acceptance criteria?
I'll do both. For instance, Aaron Medical, we recently got new CPT codes for both of our products. So it's an overarching question of, can I fund this? Can I keep this company funded? So what are venture capitalists looking for also? So I'm not averse to PMA products, but I haven't done one in quite a while. I have been sticking with 510Ks, but in a lot of ways, the PMA process isn't that much different than a 510K with clinicals. But yeah, I've been sticking with 510Ks just because it's just a little bit safer, easier route.
Other things like patent protection, like competitive landscape, like opportunities, companies buying the technology.
Yeah, no, all those things. You've probably named the next three. So patent protection, you have to be able to have not only freedom to operate, but the ability to prevent other people from fast following you. It's nice to have natural acquirers in the field. Fields like AFib, I mentioned, there's lots of acquirers very interested in the next thing. That's always nice because it gives you this dual path. You don't have to rely on an IPO. Eventually, you can have a dual path, either acquired or go IPO eventually. Yeah, and then you look, obviously, at competition. What's out there right now and how well does it, how big a medical need is this? Is it something that your idea is going to be that much better than the competition?
And one of the overarching things that you talk about, is it fundable? It's interesting to me. It passes my criteria for something that I want to get involved with, and I think I can get it funded.
Right. That's that. Yeah. Because, and I think it's also because I've been through, like the funding process is painful. There's nothing fun about it. And if you like, unless you like to be told no 100 times in a row and told it's just...
And your baby's ugly.
Your baby's ugly. So that's really what this funding process is. Now, you have to keep reminding yourself, you only have to be told yes once or twice, and then you keep going on. But when you've been through companies that can't get funded, then it's really painful and you don't want to go through that again. That's always in the back of my mind. Friend of mine, Dan Hawkins, talks about founding Shockwave and with John Adams, and he couldn't get funded, and so he said, "Okay, we'll stop trying for a little while," and then either the world changed or his story changed or something changed, and then he got financed. So there's a lot about the cycles of financing. Sometimes it's just not, there's no funding available through no fault of anybody's, really.
We didn't talk about team, and that's one of the things I'm sure when you're on the other side of the table, that's one of the main things. But when you're evaluating an idea, how do you put team in there too? Is that a risk that you're weighing as an entrepreneur, or are you assuming that you can develop that team?
That's why I live in the Bay Area, is because I'm assuming I can develop that team here. The team for Aaron's startup was me and then Andrew Frazier, who's our VP of engineering now, and he's just a true engineer who can, if I have an idea, he can build a prototype in a couple of days, hand it back to me, and we can go to the animal lab. To me, that's the perfect team. I never have any idea, or I haven't come across any ideas that require, quantum physics yet. So I think we can build a team around here.
So what we've kind of discussed is two people have been through the startup thing and learned a lot of tough lessons along the way, and have come to talk a little bit in shortcuts of things that we've learned. Six startups didn't all go well. You learned all of these lessons along the way, and in between those six startups, you were moving in and out of the venture community.
Right.
So let's put your venture hat on for a second. What does the process look like from a VC standpoint?
So first of all, they are looking for a very large return on their investment. And because they have a portfolio of companies, they know some are going to work and some aren't, that the ones that do work, they want to be able to get a lot, a big return. And they're not talking about like 20% a year. They're talking about that we want 10 times our money back. That kind of shapes the entire viewpoint of a venture capitalist for the way their business works. They need to get these very large returns. So
And they need to get it in a certain time frame for the life of the fund.
Exactly. It has to be in a certain time frame. And depending on where they are in the life cycle of the fund, they're looking for different things. So they might be towards the tail, let's say the last investment of the fund. They don't want to invest in something that's going to take 10 years. They want something that's nearer term. So there's a lot, that goes into their thinking that relates to how a venture capital fund works. But that the first thing is, time frames and return colors a lot of it. So it's difficult. And also the size of the funds. So if you have, let's say, a $50 million fund, that fund can make $1 million investments and get, let's say, they can get a few million dollars into a company over the lifetime of that investment. That's okay for a $50 million fund. But a $5 billion fund, it has to be able to invest a very large amount of money into any company, because they can't just have 1,000 companies in their portfolio. They're on the boards of these companies. So it's harder for really large funds to invest in early stage medical devices because the investments are smaller, the timeframes are longer. That, I guess, is most of the thinking is, around those sort of portfolio management kind of, thoughts.
And then weighing the criteria, we went through from an entrepreneur standpoint, what you're looking for. From a VC standpoint, are they looking for the same things, but in a different order?
Yeah, I would say so. I'd say they're looking at exactly the same things. And for instance, patent, there's some risks that they're not willing to take. So they're not willing to take any intellectual property risk, no market risk. They want these large markets where that if you can develop this product, it will have a large market and it will generate a lot of sales. They're willing to take some technical risk. Okay, will this technology work? Can this team develop this technology? Those are the kind of risks that they are very good at evaluating. Yeah, they'll put a lot of effort into looking at market and talking to physicians and really trying to see if there's a market there, and if there is, then looking at the technology and evaluating whether it's actually going to, that's the bet they're taking, that this technology and this team can develop this.
Yeah, a common saying within the industry, and it's common, is, you know, you bet on the jockey, not on the horse. Is that true?
There's not a lot of, I've found not a lot of cronyism, you know, in venture capital, that it's, you know, pretty hard dollars and cents and technology kind of decision making. At least that's been my experience.
It's a lot easier to take the meeting to when you've got an experienced entrepreneur.
That's right.
It's a lot easier to get into the conversation. But when it all boils down to it, all of those other criteria that we looked at still have to be met.
Yeah, that's right. Especially in medical device. It might be different in other, you know, in health tech or in healthcare services. I don't know. But in devices, I don't think people are making more risky decisions on technology or on patents because it's their favorite CEO.
You've been on both sides of the table when you're making presentations, and I'm sure you learned some things early on, what to say, what not to say. And then when you're on the VC side, what do entrepreneurs not know that they're doing incorrectly when they're in a meeting with a VC?
That's a good question. I talk to young entrepreneurs about this. I tell them, you are the expert. You are going in to share your expertise about this with these potential investors. So be confident, be sure of your answers. If you don't know something, you'll say why you don't know, if it's something that you should know, and how you're going to find out and how you're going to answer that question. But the confidence is, I think, lacking a lot of first-time entrepreneurs because, yeah, it can be very intimidating. There's a lot riding on the outcome. The other is, know what questions are going to be asked in advance. So you should vet this, do your presentation multiple times with other people, see what questions come up. Do it as many times as you can because the questions are usually the same between potential investors. So you shouldn't be surprised by any questions that are being asked. And you should have a plan, a real plan for getting this product developed, but also getting through the FDA, getting reimbursement and sales marketing. This should be a real plan. It doesn't have to be a fully baked business plan with numbers attached 5 years out, but you have to know the life cycle of this product.
I think one of the other things that I learned through the process too is doing your homework on the person that's across the table from you. You need to know, as we said, you need to know where they are in their fund, where you are, what other investments they've made in the space. Are they typically investing in the type of round that you're in? Are they a seed investor? Are they a B investor? You know, kind of where what's their sweet spot for it? That's basically sales 101. Is you need to understand the other side's motivations before you start pitching.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. And then and have your experts ready to answer their questions. Your scientific advisors or medical advisory board ready to, because you've obviously vetted your idea with these, you know, experts, and they should be willing to talk to the investors for you to tell them why they think it's a good idea.
Just some great information in the last 30 minutes we put together. Hard learned facts.
All hard learned, you know, because I had, you know, when I first started, I've made most of the mistakes that that new entrepreneurs are going to make.
I think that kind of going back to, if you're going to spend the next 5, 8, 10 years with an idea, you better know what makes it successful. What makes a successful idea? And you just laid out all of the different criteria. And basically what you're trying to do is mitigate the risks associated with this idea, make sure that there's a great opportunity at the tail end of this thing. And as you said, it's also keeping an eye on, is it fundable? Can I put the fuel in there to make this happen? Because funding is a significant risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the most significant risks that a startup has.
Right. Yeah. No, it's very, at one point I got funding from the government of Singapore because they were looking to experience entrepreneurs, maybe employ people there and teach people how to build companies. And so they gave me, you know, a significant amount of funding, and I went out to Singapore quite a bit to, so you have to explore other avenues. Just do whatever you can to keep the company going certain times, because you have to really believe in that the company will have an outcome like Aaron Medical is having right now, that you're able to actually really positively change the practice of medicine.
Well, let's talk about Aaron. Really a fascinating technology being applied into a problem area. So tell us about what the problem is that Aaron is solving.
Yeah, so we're developing non-invasive solutions, office-friendly treatments for a host of chronic nasal airway conditions. And so our first two products are solving nasal airway obstruction. So just having this feeling or not being able to get enough air through your nose. So that's our first product, Vivair. Our second product is Rhinair, which treats chronic rhinitis. So a chronically runny nose, post-nasal drip, just overactive mucus production in your nose that affects millions of people. And it's a very common condition, especially as people age.
What is the, you know, kind of go a little bit further into the problem. What happens when somebody has an obstructed nasal passage? What's that person's life like? How's it impacted?
The patient journey, you know, we call it. But that is actually the question I asked when I first got into this. So I was attracted to ENT because there are physicians that do procedures in the OR. They see patients in the office. They can do, you know, and they can do office procedures. I thought it was ripe for maybe moving some of the things that they did in the OR to the office, or providing them new things to do in the OR. So I actually looked in the beginning. I went to ENTs and I said, "What do your patients complain about? You know what?" And so nasal obstruction was number one, and I started to look into what the actual problem was. So if you think of it in physics terms, the problem is, you know, not getting enough air into your nose. So where is the resistance coming from? And I discovered this thing I never heard of called the nasal valve. So it's the area of greatest resistance in your entire nasal airway. And it's really what Breathe Right strips work on. So those nasal strips that pull the sides of your nose open, that's pulling open this nasal valve area. It's where like 60% of nasal resistance. And just about everybody breathes better if you put on a nasal strip or you pull the sides of your nose open. So that got me thinking, okay, would everybody then benefit if we could just enlarge that area a little bit using radio frequency energy? That's where this idea came from. We spent a lot of time looking, can you safely treat, you know, use radio frequency in this area? And you can't, because traditional radio frequency is really ablative. So we had to develop a way that you could apply radio frequency to shape and open the nasal airway without really damaging the mucosa, where you would have mucosal ulcers or even perforation. So we had to develop a very safe way of applying radio frequency to the mucosa in the nose, and that we developed a temperature controlled radio frequency to do it.
Scott, one of the other issues, I don't know if this is how you're applying the technology to, is with people with apnea, sleep apnea, people who snore. Is this something that helps solve those issues as well?
I'll take snoring first, because we can definitely help a certain population who snores. If you have nasal airway obstruction, you can snore just from that, because when you breathe in, you produce too much negative pressure and it causes your palate to vibrate. And if you open up the nose in a lot of those patients, that snoring will stop. Our studies have shown that people report less snoring after our procedure who snored before, And we have a lot of really good data on improving sleep. People feel more refreshed when they wake up. It's definitely something that can help with sleep disordered breathing. When you talk about sleep apnea, that is a lot of patients with sleep apnea also have problems with their tongue falling back, and it's a multifactorial problem. So we would never really say that we can treat sleep apnea, but we can definitely help some patients with snoring and other sleep disordered problems.
So from a patient, you know, kind of going back to patient standpoint, they're having difficulty breathing out of one or both nostrils, and you open this up. Is there a medical issue that you're solving other than uncomfortable feeling in the patient?
Sleep is probably the biggest one. Sleep and well-being. So it just, people are much happier and feel better when they breathe through their nose. So those patients, you know, if they go to see their ENT, the ENT will do what's called a Cottle maneuver, which is basically opening up this nasal valve area that we talked about. If they can breathe better after having the Cottle maneuver, the Vivera procedure in the office is likely to help that those patients don't necessarily have to go to surgery anymore. That's what we were trying to, is provide patients who either aren't surgical candidates or don't want to have surgery another option for getting better nose breathing.
As a father of a woman who had a deviated septum and had surgery and it did not work properly, she's still having problems too, breathing as an adult. I think this is interesting technology.
Well, one reason that you know, deviated septum surgeries might not work is because there could be a nasal valve problem on top of that. And so that is something she might want to check with her ENT about.
Yeah. So you mentioned reimbursement. Is this the product that you just recently got some positive news on reimbursement?
Yeah, both of them. So Vivera for nasal obstruction, that code went into effect at the beginning of this year. So that's being covered by Medicare and Medicaid, and then private insurers are making their own decisions about it. And then our Ryanair code goes into effect at the beginning of 2024.
Let's talk about Ryanair for a little bit and what problem that's solving.
Yeah, so Ryanair solves the problem of too much mucus produced in the nose, so chronic rhinitis. And these patients can have just clear fluid dripping from their nose. So people walk around holding a tissue all the time and sniffling, and it can also be allergic rhinitis, which is associated with congestion and itching and sneezing, and both can be associated with postnasal drip. Millions of people have this, but there's really been nothing to treat it other than the medication. And the medication, a lot of people don't respond or don't tolerate it well, or just don't want to be on medication for the rest of their lives. What our device does, what Ryanair does, is it goes in and ablates the nerves that control mucus production. And they happen to be in an area of the nose that we can reach with the Ryanair device. And we apply radio frequency energy over the area of the nerves in multiple areas. We have a very high success rate in our randomized control trial. So it's been very exciting. And while doing Ryanair, we can also use that same technology to reduce the size of enlarged turbinates and reduce the size of nasal swell bodies, which are another thing that can cause congestion. So we can also reduce congestion along with reducing the overproduction of mucus.
So you got two problems. Patients come to the ENT to get diagnosed, and they can get it done at the time or in the physician's office. And it's, how long is the procedure? Less than a half hour?
It's less than a half hour, I would say, average of 20 minutes of actual procedure time. We provide topical and some injected anesthetic, so that needs to take into account. So you're in and out of the office much less than an hour, but the actual procedure is about 20 minutes.
Tell me about the training that a physician would need to have for this product or these products.
Yeah, no, it's actually pretty great. For Vivera, you really don't even need to use an endoscope. Everything you're treating is in the front of the nose. So they're they're really up and running after seeing a video, and we'll be there with them in the first cases. But it's a very short learning curve. It's working on areas that the ENT physician is very familiar with accessing and working on in other procedures.
As far as the product itself, I'm assuming that there's a power source and then there's wands of some sort as well?
That's right. We have a generator, and then we plug in two different hand pieces, and the generator will read the hand piece and know which procedure to provide.
As far as business model, are you selling these devices, leasing the power? How's the business model work?
We're selling the disposable hand pieces and then giving away a generator with the purchase of a box of hand pieces. And then the generator can stay in their office.
Is this something that is a new service, new revenue generator, so to speak, for the physician?
It definitely is. Yeah, it definitely is. And it is something they can incorporate easily in their practice. The generator needs a very small place to sit, you know, a countertop, and it's a very small footprint. The prevalence of nasal airway obstruction is about 30% in the U.S. And of the patients that actually walk into the ENT's office, it's a lot higher, even if they're coming in for something else. So this allows them to offer a pretty low, no downtime way in the office of treating those patients that they wouldn't normally be able to offer anything to.
Up until just recently, when you received your reimbursement, was this an out-of-pocket cost for patients?
It was, yes. It was out-of-pocket for treating the lateral wall of the nose, but there were some codes available for other uses of the device.
So the regulatory pathway for these devices were 510Ks?
That's right, 510Ks, yes.
With or without clinical data?
With our clinical data.
With clinicals.
We went into the FDA. We did a meeting with them and told them what we planned to do. So worked it out in advance, what clinical data we'd be providing with them.
So sometimes when we do our clinical studies for regulatory, it's a more of a finite group of patients. But when we take it out into the marketplace, we need additional data. Was your data for the regulatory submission sufficient for the market, or did you need to do additional clinical studies once you hit the market?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because it is a different, there's a different goal for different clinical data. We had the goal of getting FDA clearance of our 510K, but then also getting new codes. So we did many more studies after, because to get a new code needs a randomized control study plus and really about five peer-reviewed journals with different studies. So we did many more studies after the FDA study, including a randomized sham-controlled study for each product.
How are you distributing the product? Do you have a direct sales force, or is it a distributor
sales force? We have a direct sales force.
And available in the U.S.? Are you available outside the U.S.?
U.S. only right now.
What does the next couple of years look like? Really hitting the market hard and getting market adoption, new products? What does it look like?
We want to really there's tremendous opportunity in both of our current products. We're really focusing on giving our physician users the best possible experience. So there'll be updates to those existing products. So that's really our main focus for the next couple of years. But there are also additional opportunities in ENT that we want to develop products for. We're working hard on our pipeline and have some things in the hopper and, you know, things that we're looking at. So we want to really continue to offer as much innovation as we can in the field of ENT medicine. It's a field that everybody needs good nasal breathing and good function in their nose. And there's a lot of conditions that I think that we can help with. We're going to devote a lot of energy to doing that.
Well, Scott, it's a very interesting problem, two problems that you're solving. And I think most of us know someone who has one or both of these issues. And knowing about this, I think, would be very interesting for our listeners. And then finding the clinicians who can perform these procedures or be able to talk them through to see if they're eligible for these procedures is going to be something I think will be very interesting, again, for our listeners to evaluate whether it can help them or someone that they're related to.
Our website has a physician finder and information on both of our products, Aaron Medical, AERIN.com, AaronMedical.com.
How'd you come up with the name Aaron?
Because air goes in your nose and I want more air in. And then I spelled it I thought it was a fancy way of spelling it. I got both spellings as a URL, but so Aaron. And then I was able to buy the URL, the website Aaron.com. So just AERAN. They wanted $850 for it. I said, oh, you're dreaming. And I offered them like $500 for it. And they said no. And they sold it to like Estee Lauder Company. So I probably could have funded Aaron by just buying that URL and selling it. So, yeah.
Scott, thanks so much for a great conversation. I do have another question. And going back to where we, you know, where we kind of started, and it's that entrepreneur VC side of things. Companies can't function without money, and money can't do anything without great ideas and great people to be able to implement something and build something. But sometimes some of these investment decisions are kind of outside of the control of an entrepreneur. You could get hit with COVID. You could get hit with a down cycle, in addition to what you have as a product. There are a lot of great ideas that, for whatever reason, don't hit the funding cycle and aren't able to be realized, even though they're a good idea. Is our current system for investing in medical device working properly? And are there some ways that we can make it better than what it is?
I think you've correctly pointed out the issues. I think that the system of bringing ideas to market is flawed, and it's really cyclical. There are times when early stage money just dries up. There's the very early stage money that is friends and family and angels. If you don't know people, it's very difficult to tap into. There's this mid stage where traditionally smaller VCs might play, and that's an ever-changing universe where smaller funds make those earlier stage investments in medical devices, but those firms might get bigger and not want to make those investments, or they might be at the wrong fund cycle. And then there's later stage investment, which the universe is perfectly set for. There's large VCs and private equity investors. So once you get past this earlier stages, you can start, if you survive, that long, you can act there, that world works. But this earlier stage world is chaotic and is a little hit or miss. And that's why it has required passionate entrepreneurs who are willing to turn over every stone to get this financing done. Because that's really the only way that it happens. So there's groups like Fogarty Innovation that are trying to bridge that and help entrepreneurs. There's incubators like Y Combinator that has funded a lot of early stage healthcare companies. And I think that's what's really needed, is a sustaining universe of that kind of funding. But in my long career, I just haven't really seen a huge change in it. I don't have any good answers except to say that it still is possible for one person with an idea, if they're willing to knock on a lot of doors and kiss a lot of frogs, to get it done. And it's still fun and rewarding. And if I have any good ideas for changing the infrastructure, I'll let you know.
Entrepreneurs are important in bringing innovations to healthcare, but they're not the only ones that do it. We need investment to make our visions come to life. I appreciated that Scott could look at things more holistically based on his experience as a VC, as well as an operator. A few of my takeaways. First of all, being a serial entrepreneur. Now, it's a lot like riding a wild roller coaster with its share of crazy ups and downs. You're constantly facing challenges like the pressure to keep innovating, the fear of failing, which is always lurking around, and the whole whirlwind of managing multiple projects at once. But hey, in the midst of all that chaos, there's this incredible chance to learn and grow like never before. Each new venture teaches you things you'd never learn otherwise. And that makes you more adaptable, tougher, and giving you a real killer instinct for sniffing out opportunities. And then let's not forget the thrill of chasing different passions and the potential for massive success. Yeah, it's a wild ride, but for a serial entrepreneur, it's the thrill that keeps us going. The second is know your operating thesis. And he talked, you know, really in depth on what the profile is of the type of opportunity that he wants to work on. It's got to be something with a big idea, big market, and it's a new idea, reasonable regulatory pathway, a path to reimbursement, fundable. He's open to you know, different types of regulatory pathways, but he wants to de-risk the deal as much as possible and make sure that there's a big opportunity there, because it's a lot of time and effort that's going to go into building this company. So what he's done, and what I suggest that all of us do, is look for patterns and continue to hone the criteria of the things that you look to get involved with. If you're a serial entrepreneur, stakes are big. Make sure that you know what is inside and what's outside of the opportunities that you'll take on. The last thing was advice to entrepreneurs when pitching to investors. And this kind of goes across all pitches, whether we're pitching to investors or pitching an idea within a company. Be confident. You're the expert in this area. Make sure that you're confident when you're talking to people. Predict the questions that are coming. Most of the questions that are coming are things that you can predict in having conversations with others. So make sure that you prepare. And then if you don't know, say so. And what I liked what Scott said is say why you don't know. If you've got a good explanation on why you don't know, it will go a long way in making sure that they know that you're confident that you're going to be able to get it. And the final thing was have a real plan. They expect you. They expect you to have thought through the product, but they also expect you to think through regulatory, reimbursement, sales, marketing, everything else about your business. Thank you for listening. Make sure you get episodes downloaded to your device automatically by liking or subscribing to the Mastering Medical Device podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please spread the word and tell a friend or two to listen to the Mastering Medical Device podcast, as interviews like today's can help you become a more effective medical device leader. Work hard. Be kind.